Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You serious?
Yes, this is How to Kill an Hour. My name is Marcus Bronzy. Thank you in advance for killing some time with us. I want to jump straight into it. I'm very excited about today's show because I'm joined by a very funny man, a very woke man, Dane Baptiste. What's going on, brother?
I'm good, bro. How are you?
I'm good, man. Thank you very much. I mean, like, I'll be honest, we did have a little bit of a jiggle around with times for our recording. So I appreciate you bearing with me and making sure that this happened because I'm super excited to talk about your recent projects. I just can't wait to get into it, man.
But before... My pleasure, man. My pleasure. Always good to catch up. And I'm always enthused to be recreating with people over the, this whole new digital stratosphere and that. And
exactly.
You guys are one stone checking on the homies and talking about new work and stuff. So it's all good, man.
Always good. Yeah, I mean, this isn't your first time on the show. If you'd like to check when Dane was last on How to Kill an Hour, he was on episode 341. And you were on an episode before then. But I think if you listen to episode 341, we'll tell you the original episode Dane was on the show as well. So you can check out everything Dane has been up to. But Dane, I just want to talk to you about Bamus. I want to get straight into it. But actually, no, before that, I want to know about you. How is lockdown treating you, sir? Because, you know, we're in lockdown, the proper lockdown number 3 in 2021, aren't we?
This is it, yeah. The third one for the foreseeable future. It's the franchise that nobody asked for, but everybody was kind of expecting. And in that respect alone, it's been quite tough. Like, I think the weekend that's gone, I found myself, particularly bored, which is always tough. And I think for most people, it's that kind of boredom and the tedium that gets us. But I'm always able to offset that by knowing that a lot of people got a lot worse than I have. And for me, really, lockdown isn't the biggest of our societal ills right now. I guess I'm bored and stuff, and I'd like to be gigging live and stuff. But really, I think there needs to be other global changes, not just ones in terms of like how the virus is affecting us. So I think we are plagued by a number of ills, not just the corona. So I'm cool, really, I guess. How about yourself?
100%. I've been good, man. I think I kind of mirror how you feel. I'm very aware that there's people that are worse off generally before lockdown. You know, there's people that had worse problems than not being able to leave the house. I'm aware of that. And also, you know, I don't want to sound antisocial, but I'm all right with not seeing a few people.
Me too. I think, it really helps to evaluate the fact that like a large part of our social time or our social life is spent with people who we don't necessarily enjoy the company of, but have to acquaint ourselves with for whatever professional or capitalist reasons there are. And it's like, I think a lot of people have reached that kind of had that epiphany where they've kind of been like, I don't need to do that to have a life. Really? Yeah. Let's talk to people I need to talk to. I found it's been good peace of mind where I can electively choose the company I keep. Rather than being forced into it by the medium of my work. So I agree with you as well. It's not antisocial. It's like, you know, I think most people should enjoy their own company before they go and impose on anyone else's space.
Love yourself before you go out there and start loving other people. That's what I always say. And around that as well, I had a good few drinks over Christmas and I said I wanted to have a dry January and I had a very dry January. It wasn't 100% dry, but like damp. And I feel like I might want to continue staying very dry throughout the year. I drink alcohol. I like to have a drink. I like to have a few drinks. I might do like around birthdays and around a few other big events, but I'm really practicing the self-control of just having none or having one. I think that's easier as well. When I'm in environments that I can control, as in my own place, instead of being at a bar and stuff, I find it easier to be like, you know what? I won't crack open a bottle of wine. I might have a non-alcoholic beer, or I might just have a juice or something like that. So I'm feeling a little bit of self-control. Not the same sort of self-control when it comes to biscuits though, Dane, because let's face it, who eats one biscuit?
Listen, you got to substitute one vice for another, Marcus. So yeah. I totally understand that. You know, if you're just, you know, the biscuits are just filling the hole where alcohol used to, I completely understand that. You know, you're swapping one type of bourbon for another type of bourbon. So, you know, I'm with it 100% of the way. You know who eats one biscuit? Who? Inmates and sociopaths. That's who eats one biscuit. And maybe like various pets. Biscuits are
not allowed anymore. Yeah,
exactly. Like it's having, Cause and that's because they're not allowed to anymore. Yeah. Like, you know, as a child, even your most basic infant instincts will tell you one biscuit is not enough.
It's never enough. It's never enough.
You need one. You just need one for the trip back from the tin.
Yeah, that's what, do you know what, Dana? We're going to digress before we even get to Bamers, right? But that's the worst thing. I found myself going, right, so I'm going to have two biscuits. This is a lie, the numbers. Two biscuits while I watch TV and drink my cup of coffee.
You know, people go, how many units of alcohol do you have a week? Probably two. Two. I think I have 2 units a week. And that's only when, you know, I've got nothing else to do. I have two biscuits with, you know, you couldn't even finish, get to the sofa with two biscuits, Marcus. From the living room door to the sofa, you get through two biscuits just on that trip alone.
Telling you, bruv. I start trying to do the maths though. But you're right. I come like, right, okay, I'm going to need a biscuit on the route, And you know, if it's a little dunk that I'm having as well, that biscuits, I can't, you know, eat that slowly. I've got to rush that biscuit. So if I'm dunking, I need to double the amount of biscuits. Yeah, it gets crazy out there. But
It's just hedging your bets. It's just like hedging your bets. Like when I was young, it'd be like, yeah, so we're going to this day and you're going to a birthday. Mum would be like, you're going to a birthday party. Yes, there'll be like party rings there, jammy dodgers, all the fixings and trimmings. But you can't always guarantee that. So you have to have a little bowl of food beforehand. Because the last thing you want to be is the one greedy ADHD kid that is just destroying the buffet table.
Yeah. The little vex food before you go to the dance.
There you go. That's it. So nowadays, I think two biscuit minimum is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I like that. I could see that in your campaign. Dane says two biscuit minimum.
And I'm telling you, like, you know, have you heard the pubs are supposed to be opening again, but they're not going to be serving alcohol?
Yeah, that's a bit of an oxymoron. When I heard that, I was like, why would you even do that? Why? Yeah, why so are they doing that?
Two biscuit minimum is going to become a lot more. It's going to become big because, you know, for your discerning, you know, beverage enjoyer who doesn't want to go to Starbucks and deal with all of that, you know, haughty crap.
Yeah.
They're going to want to be able to go, you know, have a nice biscuit in a local pub.
Have a bourbon with lads.
Yeah, have a bourbon. And then, you know, that's what the point is going to get to, is that people are going to be like, lads, this is no need to argue. Let's have a custard cream each. Talk it out.
Yeah.
People will be like, this guy's fucking Marcus Brunsey. I heard he had a whole packet of custard creams on the way around here. Boy, that guy's got a problem. I'm not going to tell him, though. Last time someone said that, he put a Gary Bordy around the back of their bloody head.
I'll tell you what though, Dane, with alcohol, I secretly, and a lot of my friends are like me saying this, I kind of want them to be strict with alcohol. I almost want a zero tolerance on alcohol, because I reckon the more illegal alcohol is, the better kind of prohibition bars we're going to get. We're going to get real speakeasies. I want to go into I want to go to the barber shop and I want to say, can I have a short back and sides? And, yeah, I want a facial with that as well. Actually, that sounds a bit wrong. Hey.
I don't know if I'm the cops off the scent, Marcus.
I want to say whatever code word it is. I want the men's special. It's not getting any better. I want the men's special. I want him to like go over to the like a cabinet. I want him to pull a little lever and I want my chair to sink into the floor. And I want to like land next to you, Dane, and be hey, how's it going, bro?
And I just tip my fedora and go, hey there, brother.
yeah. And the bar person turns to us and goes, regular? And I'd be like, hell yes. Serve it up.
Hell yeah.
And then he goes,
one shot back and sides. Coming up, Mr. Brunsey.
Get me. Accountants looking through my paperwork. Marcus, you had 17 haircuts last week alone. Interesting.
You're like, listen, you know, the tax and it's a write-off and, you know, dealing with various, the beard and... hair's come out there. Better get down to the barbershop to fix that. Can't take a risk in this line of work. I don't know. I don't think we could do prohibition in this country. I don't know if we could go back to only, but I think that's only because you're right the first time that if alcohol becomes illegal, people would do stuff like facials and literally, you know, where they spray you with like rubbing alcohol in the barbershop, people would be like, spray that in my face, in my eyes. I need please take that barbicide, that blue juice, and pour it in my eyes. I have not had alcohol in months. I could see people going, because I think it's people always find the way. As long as people know how to ferment sugar, then, you know, you'll get crazy shit. People will be like, what are you drinking? Soy candle. What? Yeah, but this soy candle actually is made from various berries and sort of, and some yeast, and then you just like a nice beer. People will do anything, whatever it takes to make alcohol. So
the most amount of hooch outside of prison for years, 100%. Anyway, Dane, before we further digress, one of the reasons I wanted to have you back on the show, you are always welcome to come on the show, Dane, is a project. Oh, thank you, man. A project of yours called Bamus, which is currently creating waves. Should we just take it back to like where Bamus came from? What is Bamus maybe? And then where it came from as well.
Absolutely. I mean, if I'm honest, I probably don't have the artistic or the expanse of artistic vision to know whether or not Bamus is my opus, but it really is one of the most one of the projects I'm most excited about, and I'd like to think one of the truest representations of my work that I've done thus far. It's so where Bamus essentially comes from is a part of my, I guess, my impetus to become a comic in the first place and aspire to be a professional comedian, but it's basically around a lot of the way my horizons were broadened when I entered into the industry. So my debut comedy show, my first 1 hour one-man show, was nominated for Best Newcomer at the 2014 Edinburgh Awards. For those who don't know, it's the world's largest art festival, and it transpires that I was the first Black British artist to receive a nomination. Now, this is obviously an amazing feat, which I embrace and I'm humbled and flattered to receive. At the same time, I would be lying if I said I wasn't somewhat nonplussed by the fact that there weren't any previous recipients before, because I was more than aware of my predecessors when I started doing comedy, and it was strange that they hadn't received any plaudits for their work because I'd found it so inspirational. And, you know, then the knock-on effect of that was that I was fortunate enough to have a commission for a sitcom, which is Sunny D, which then transpired to be the first Black British sitcom that had been on the BBC and on British TV in 20 years. So again, an amazing career milestone, something I'm happy to be a part of. But again, was very confusing and troubling that there had not been a creation of a sitcom which had a majority Black cast on British TV in two decades, which is pretty much a generation. And so it began to become a lot more apparent to me than I had previously thought that there had been, I guess, the equivalent of a dark age where, you know, Black Britons or any members of the diaspora had not had anything shown on television which was representative of themselves. And as a result, an entire generation kind of lost out on, I guess, today's opportunities for people to create their own, entertainment portals via social media. So I thought about that. And then I guess it was looking at my predecessors in terms of like working out the reasons why I might be the first recipient for an award in Edinburgh. And then seeing, the marginalization that a lot of my predecessors kind of dealt with. And then it was a factor of looking at the career trajectory of most Black creatives. There always seemed to be some kind of disconnect whereby for you to realize mainstream success, with that analogy, that stream would then, by the same token, dilute what you were doing as an act. And so even though you'd be gaining some level of notoriety or credibility amongst larger mainstream audiences, it would come at the cost of losing credibility from your core audience. And I guess I was wanting to try to work out how to balance that duality whereby you can still be famous and remain and retain your Blackness. And so how can I still be Black and famous? Is how Bamus was a marriage of those two words. And as a result of which, it was kind of like I would be... And then I started seeing a lot of other fairs, particularly in digital media, within podcasts and the like, where I'd see shows like Drink Champs, where the explicit narrative about hip hop at the time was that it's a young man's game. If you reach over your 30s plus, your relevance and the relevance of your narrative in common and music and entertainment is reduced. But I always felt like that wasn't the case outside of our community. And then I saw people like Noriega who would constantly reference the fact that we should give people flowers while they are here. And so again, that was kind of the catalyst for Bamus, whereby I wanted to create, I guess, a digital florist where you would honor my predecessors. And I guess I looked at currently, when you look at the landscape of digital media, there seems to be opportunities abound for younger Black and brown creatives, which is an amazing time to be in. But I guess from the perspective of being involved in the industry, was aware that there is a shelf life for that appeal, whereby those of us who are doing brand partnerships and paid partnerships and having a profile now would hit a certain age where, in a society which doesn't really have a lot of context for Black people of a certain age, and so those opportunities would begin to dwindle. So I wanted to create basically a format which would provide just an anthology of Black creativity, whereby, you know, this, when we discuss race relations in the UK, it's either people who are in denial about the race relations or will try and refer to us as being post-racial. And yeah, some people who were just by the token of like, or the Black creatives not seeing any representation of Black people in their country for 20 years, were under the supposition that, you know, the existence of Black culture was a relatively new phenomenon in the UK. And so taking all these factors into account, I wanted to create BAMUS whereby there would be a format for Black creatives whereby it could deal with the entire expanse of it. So where there are now Generation Z and younger millennials which are able to understand and exploit digital opportunities, there was a generation of equally talented people that might be 20 years their senior who didn't have the same opportunities. But at the same time, those people would resonate in the hearts and minds of the British public, but there's never been any kind of vehicle whereby that public can kind of enjoy those people. So I guess more simply put, it's like when you look at things like, you know, there's Kiss FM, but there's also Kistry, and there's like Capital Extra, but you have like, you know, but you've also got like kind of Extra Gold. And so it's taking all these things whereby it's like, for most people in the UK, especially at a time where for a large amount of time, creativity has centered around nostalgia for like the last 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, if we're going to talk about nostalgia in terms of like popular culture, it wouldn't make sense. It would make no sense for you to leave out who would be some of the most culturally significant icons within our, you know, popular culture. And so the idea of BAMUS was just to kind of celebrate all that have been Black and all that have had some fame at some point in our country. Because I think a lot of the time, the career path for your quintessential Black creative is that you may be at a young age and a certain age and you reach the apex of your career. And because we live in a country which definitely emphasizes both class as well as race, it's like if you are able to transcend your class, then there's almost then this need for British media to tear somebody down and kind of reduce what they kind of do. And this is, and that, you know, transcends even races and stuff as well. It's kind of like,
yeah,
nobody minded end ups when they seem to be like young kids out of North London, when they become fully grown adults with their own inclinations and viewpoints and opinions and, you know, own desires, it became too much for the British public to enjoy. Or, you know, in the same way that like you have the undeniable influence of like the Stowe Solid crew and how big they got and being Brits Awards and being on the cusp of like a nationwide tour,
yeah,
for them to then disappear from public screen and then be replaced dubiously by like Blazing Squad, I was found kind of strange. I find it very strange. Or even the fact that like, you know, you look at someone like Labyrinth, who is a writer, rapper, singer, producer.
Fantastic producer, yeah.
Yeah, but then you look at somebody like that, and I read an article by him in Esquire magazine last year where he was kind of like, because he was in a song like Pass Out, he found that the pressure from record labels and stuff was that he would continue in that vein. And then why would a rapper make a song like Earthquake, but then also make a song like Let the Sun Shine?
Yeah.
And Valid. And it's like, because he can. And it's like, by the same token, you know, you live in a country where nobody questions Ed Sheeran about this. And that diversity and range is celebrated.
You mean like more specifically when Ed would rap, for example, in some of his songs? Yeah.
Ed would rap and people would celebrate that and he'd have his remixes and stuff like that as well. And or a better example would be, remember Plan B had an entire conceptual album based on that whole premise of showing this diversity and this kind of range within his artistry. But then you look at with his Black counterparts, like someone like Labyrinth, and it's not palatable to British, to the big, the music industry. And I put that down to the fact that it's not just a question of like, you know, just suppressing a Black entertainer's voice, but it's, again, if you have an entire generation of people who have not seen any fare from any Black creatives, it's very hard for them to conceptualize this, that this is within their own country. So for me, it's another way BAMUS works is that I want to be for the white people that grew up watching Chris Akabusi on like Saturday morning TV or watching Andy Peters, like, those people need to understand that, you know, Chunks and Philly are the Andy Peters and all the Ants and Deco of today. And I just wanted to kind of create an archive and an anthology which celebrates all of these faces. And by that same token, I guess, slots them into British culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel, and, you know, that does mean that there are discussions about race and, you know, there are some uncomfortable ones. But I think what has been the primary cause of antagonism, particularly in the UK, has been the reluctance for that conversation. And so Baymus is basically me grandstanding, being like, we are here, we're black, we're British, we're not going anywhere, clearly. Let's talk about it.
And that was a relatively serious answer, Dane, but the show's funny. So how did you make it something that was also very funny? Because throughout it, it's rip-roar, but you are delivering us great value in terms of information and knowledge. How did you make it? How did you make it something that you can watch and be entertained and educated at the same time?
I think it's a natural part of the gift, I guess, of, you know, being a black person within or being an aware slash woke black person within Western civilization, is that you using humor or using art as an outlet has always been a part of our rationalization process or a process of escapism, particularly when dealing with issues like race or racial oppression, number one. So that's a natural part of what I do. I guess Baymus has also been an extension of the work I've been doing in comedy in the first place, is whereby rather than using race relations to discuss the pronounced differences between black and white people and everyone in between, it's more about celebrating the nuance of my existence and the existence of my community, and then finding the parallels between that and British culture and stuff as well. And I think there's some of that, and I think that's part of it, is some of the jokes where it's like people having the realization that some of the same psychological issues or issues of consciousness that we deal with as black people are the same as anybody. Everyone knows what it's like to deal with industrial frustration. But then at the same time, it's kind of like, I think ridicule is just a very effective way of dismantling, you know, regressive systems. It's a very effective way of having, you know, of defending yourself against your oppressor. And, you know, it's one of these things whereby for every action, there's an equal but opposite reaction. And you could return the same kind of vitriol, and I could come on to camera and be accusatory and be aggressive, but it's not really effective. So I just think humor is just very effective, that like, once people laugh, they get there, they can kind of let their guard down.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where we sugarcoat the pill, where they can start really, you know, looking at the themes that are being discussed in Baymus. But funny is always my go-to, first of all, as well, because I just think, you know, that's the most universal language. So I think that's the most universal language, which covers all, like, you know, socioeconomic groups, races, religions, heritage, culture, systems. And once we do that, it means that now we are speaking the same language. And then I can kind of, you know, begin to articulate what I want to say to people, really.
Cool. Right. The only spoiler I'm going to give away jokes wise about Baymus is right at the start, Dane receives a phone call from the BBC.
Hello?
Hello.
Who's that?
It's the BBC.
What? What?
Just to inform you that Sir Lenny Henry is off to Sierra Leone.
Why are you telling me this?
Because it's your turn.
My turn? My turn? Yeah, it's my turn. No, it's our turn.
Did it tell the truth? Did it feel a bit like it's my turn? Because I could totally relate to that. Like,
yeah, it felt like that a little bit. But part of the fun was exploring that complex as well, because I feel like that is a real complex that is developed for a lot of black creatives, or any black person, again, trying to thrive and also to excel within the industry, is that we're all aware of the whole Frederick Douglass narrative of crabs in a bucket. So I think a lot of the time when we think about turns and stuff, it's almost suggested to us by gatekeepers that only one of us can kind of exist within that space. So I wanted to take that kind of theme and play up to it and stuff and be like, oh, so it's my time now, yeah, and it's cute. And it's also from a comment made by Stephen K. Amos, where he himself had opined that Lenny Henry would need to die before I can get an opportunity, because there's almost like a cue. So that was a very subversive cry of solidarity amongst all of my other black comedy creative, because it's so much often referred to as like a solitary art form. So yeah. I kind of wanted to play up to that as well. And also to almost in a way kind of throw people off the scent, because I want people to understand that Baymus obviously might be me at the helm, but it's very much a collaborative effort. And I hope it reflects the fact that history is always taught that real progress from a group is definitely made when we're all working together and stuff. But
100%.
I just think, it was just a nice bit of on the nose satire to really kind of underpin what Baymus is about the whole time. And to be honest with you, I kind of feel like it's my turn. I feel like I'm at an age now where, you know, I feel like I'm just ready to kind of take my position and just comfortably take my seat at the table and have the legs cemented, so to speak.
You hear that, comic relief? Dane's ready. Bring him through.
And it followed me, you know, just after Baymus came out, funnily enough.
Wait.
It followed me, yeah. I was like, comic relief, and I was like,
Well, well, well.
Maybe Lenny was logged into the wrong Twitter and he tried to follow you.
Yeah,
I mean,
but it's it. Yeah, he made a mistake. But you know, it's even something that is so funny.
Yeah,
and for me, I find it very funny that, you know, it's like if you have a philanthropic organization which emphasizes helping out continental Africans, it would stand to reason that like people of African descent would probably want to help out with that. So
100%, 100%. Yeah, but all right, that's cool. I mean, you do counteract like that whole crabs in a bucket scenario quite literally with Bemis by making sure that you do bring through young and fresh talent, familiar faces, not so familiar faces. Can we talk about the talent that you involved, why you decided to work with them and what they brought to the table? Because that was really nice, Dame, man. It was good to see you using that opportunity. You could have kind of kept it more to yourself, couldn't you? But you didn't. You decided to share the opportunity with others.
I feel like, you know, that community inclination sometimes for people to feel like this is my chance and I've got to maximize it. And, you know, a lot of my friends who have been supportive friends have also encouraged me to make sure that I prioritize my own prosperity a lot of the time as well, which I'm always fine doing. But again, as I say, for me, part of my self-image and I guess my indicators of success come from being able to empower other creatives through opportunities I have and work collaboratively to realize the bigger picture. So yes, for the show in the pilot episode, I have Tanya Moore, Lola Jagan, and Munya Shawawa, who's enjoyed like amazing exponential success on social media over the last year. But Bemis is actually his BBC and his television debut, which I was very happy to be able to provide a platform for that. Yeah, man, I almost, when I kind of started doing comedy, I always wanted to, as I say, do for comedy what Kanye kind of did for music. And that is kind of to revamp the image and also just to provide a new career path for people who felt like maybe their disposition and their style was outside of the narrative or outside of the typical style of comedy, and really just kind of broaden that, as well as including, like, you know, amazing people like Toussaint Douglas, who appears on the show as well. I kind of always like doing that, man. I think it always yields something positive. I think myself being, you know, the best example of that is that, you know, I came from working a regular job. I started co-founded my own management company with my management because I didn't really feel like the industry as it existed was able to cater to what my aspirations were. And, you know, as a result of which, that yielded me opportunities like Sunny D, where, you know, Sunny D was the first thing I ever wrote for television, which ended up becoming a TV series. And so, and then allowed me to provide the same opportunity for, you know, the other creators that worked on there who have now gone to have amazing careers. So yeah, historically, I always felt like we always get there together. And so there may have been the inclination to make this about myself, but I think if you really do take pride in what you do as an artist, scarcity is never going to be an issue for you. So even like with Bemis, really, like I, even though it's a pilot, like at my age in this industry, in this country, being able to take that concept and to realize it and to become something tangible is more than some people really achieve with their careers anyway. And it's exactly what I wanted to do. And like I said, it's always about if I could just begin the spark or be the catalyst to spark a conversation or be, you know, the snowflake which leads to the avalanche, then I'm always happy to kind of sit in that position. I think it's also because of like lockdown and stuff is that it's allowed me to take a lot of stock of my career and what my intentions have been as a creator. And I didn't think I'd be able to do comedy for a living because I just didn't see it happening. The last person I saw was like turning the century was like Richard Blackwood, and then he had to deal with all the bullshit of like being bankrupt. And then again, like I said, it's you go from being a top comic to once you appear to be, to take your role as a top comedian seriously, then you're open to satire and to, you know, being ridiculed by the media. And it's also one of the reasons why Richard Blackwood appears in the show as well, because I wanted to, again, make it clear that, you know, comedy and art is subjective. And while some people may have felt that at one point Richard Blackwood was seen as a buffoon for going bankrupt or his other stuff, to people like myself, he was a comedy god. And I wanted to, you know, return that credibility to him in the show. And also, again, it was for me to dovetail the whole narrative about being my turn, having, you know, other people in the show and make sure I made it as much of a collaborative process as possible, as to be like showing that while I am very happy to have a turn, I'm not ignorant of the shoulders on which I stand. And I'm also not pulling up the ladder behind me. And for me, it's like, that's that, to me, that's some of the most important part of the whole kind of artistic journey, especially because like comedy as an art form, people understand how that part works. But so far as an industry, it's a very hard thing to understand, and very only very learned people can understand what you do in comedy anyway. And so it's always nice to be surrounded by like-minded people
particularly where you find yourself massively underrepresented in an industry. So, you know, it helps me as much as it helps the people I work with. So, yeah, man, it's all good, man. These people are like family to me, and I've all known them for a very long time. And they're just doing great things, man. And I think, again, for me, that's a big part of my endeavor to be as an artist, is to have the eye to be able to curate and identify, you know, the potential of new and upcoming artists and successive generations. And just being realistic, man, I don't want to try and be like the young guy in front of the microphone my whole life, but I still want to have some artistic or executive involvement within that. So, yeah, I'm just trying to like pattern my thing like for the next 5 years.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
That's nice. That's nice. And you know what? I feel like you've got a much more enhanced awareness of your place within the industry in terms of what you can bring to the table and where you want to be. I mean, even when I messaged you like a few days ago, like saying, oh, you know what? Love what Bemis is doing. Love the energy in the show. You told me that Black programming went down last year in 2020. And that was a year where a lot of brands, you'd think forward facing, wouldn't have been the case because...
Yeah.
We have seen in the last few months that you can turn around television and movies quite quickly because we've seen things that were created during the coronavirus pandemic, like, you know, towards the end of last year. But the fact that you told me statistics like that, I found that quite shocking to hear because I hope that wasn't the case.
Me too. But no, apparently it was the case. And I think, you know, that is the kind of subversive phenomenon that we have to kind of pay attention to. And if anything, yeah, it's one of the things, one of the reasons why I just definitely try to remain very vigilant in terms of my narrative and my body of work, because in the same way, you know, that program went down last year from 2008 to 2016, we were all under the false pretense that we were in a post-racial society. And so you can see how bad the problem became, is that like people were able to justify this marginalization by being like, what's the problem with like the program has gone down, Barack Obama and blah, 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 blah. And this, I'm just definitely somebody who's always vigilant about the spectre of the dark side falling over again. Yeah, it's sad, man, and that seems to be the case. And I only became aware of that as recently as you did. And you'd think, like I said, that now we're having overt discussions about race relations and the state of which, and you know what the ramifications have been for oppression as well as privilege. You'd think that they would have some art to kind of represent that, because normally art allows for that conversation to take place without, you know, people having to deal with the task of being on a particular side in discourse. And so, yeah, it really just, for me, really reinforces why something like Bemis is so important, because, you know, in the event that, you know, programming continues to be reduced, people will now have the tools and the understanding, and in particular, the wealth and the benefit of history to be able to articulate, you know, their need and desire and deserving more opportunities. So yeah, it's for me, it reinforces why it's important. It's been happening the whole time. It's not surprising. Like, you know, when you take into account the government you're working with, some of the policies they try to implement, and you know, the state of the way the world is, it's not surprising that you're seeing this dwindling of opportunities for Black people, because a lot of the time, you know, really we can have overt conversations about addressing issues like racism, but normally it's representation within legal, industrial, or economic or political circles where you actually get to observe some change. Because it's all well and good if Coca-Cola or Starbucks say that Black Lives Matter and you can buy a coffee and be like, oh, right, the coffee's got red, black and green on it. But if you can't sit on the board of directors for Starbucks, or, you know, you can't affect, nationalize your resources because all the coffee comes from the Ivory Coast, then you're not really free and you're not really equal. And so, you know, it's for BAMIS to exist as a format in order to have those conversations and to say, how did that happen? Why has all this disappeared? How can that be the case when 10% of all music streamed in the world is from British artists and they don't look like you think they look? Because now we have the democracy of the internet, like, you see the face of British music has changed significantly. And so, yeah, in a way, I guess on the one hand, it's saddening and it's alarming to hear that. But on the other hand, I'm always somewhat nihilistic, looks at you like, so they're scared. That's why they're trying to cut down this stuff. But I guess I feel like, you know, the ants will overcome the elephant. And I think maybe there are some gatekeepers realizing the same, because I think we're going to continue to move towards a point whereby reducing your black programming and not accurately reflecting what your society and what your industry looks like is going to be to their detriment. Because, you know, like I said, at some point in time where people won't believe, hip hop was seen as a fad. Like, rap music was seen as a fad. It wasn't something that was taken seriously. And now it is the largest artistic phenomenon to come out of the United States since the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is a $1 billion industry. And so, yeah, I guess when I see things about the reduction in black and brown programming, on the one hand, yeah, it's saddening, but I think, yeah, it's just let the rest of us know, all to play for. This is the playing field, seemingly insurmountable odds. It's just another day in the office of being a black person. So,
yeah, and you know what? I think there's a lot of things that I love the internet for, and I love the internet for it being able to give people a platform to produce content that is needed by us. So, for example, you know, black programming, black comedy, should we say, has been marginalized over the years. But because of the internet, I can access that. I know where to go and find it. And I think it's a great place. I think, and I don't want to knock Manu's achievements, but the internet was a big thing that helped him to get to where he is now. Absolutely. Do you know what I mean? So
absolutely. I'd say most of the more prolific comedians over the last 3-4 years, it's been the internet. Because
100%.
There was no spaces in mm-hmm. mainstream media. So
he made his lane, lane, yeah.
Kayode Awumi and doing Roll Safe and Hood documentary was the internet. Michael Dapper was the internet. Mo Gilligan mm-hmm. was the internet. And these are all, like, these guys have become viral sensations.
Mm-hmm.
Steve the Madman is now on the cusp of having a sketch show. Lola Jagan, who also appears in BAMIS, had really garnered as Munya did, had garnered an online. And even Toussaint, who I'd known from the circuit somewhat, but it was more seeing the way that he had begun to innovate on his videos and the kind of surreal aesthetic he had used for some of the videos is one of the reasons why I'd love to use this guy in BAMIS. Yeah. So, and like I said, it's how I find them as well. And it's really been, I think narratively, it's been one of the biggest boons to the journey of the diaspora. It's been so important to having access to the internet. I really believe that the face of British music has been able to change and be more accurately reflecting of tastes because of the internet. I think, you know, the same goes for where we have seen some black creatives enjoy some prosperity on TV screens and stuff. Again, it's come from the fact that they've been able to demonstrate a very clear amount or sentiment of support based on the internet. So I think it's infinitely important. And you know, it doesn't take away from these artists at all. It's just the medium that we now use and, you know, the same one they use. And again, going back to BAMIS, what I want to do with the show is kind of make that journey a very streamlined interface. So if you are somebody that watches BAMIS, then you can start to become a bit more internet savvy by being referred to particular threads or particular notes or particular people that appear who have a much larger presence on the internet. And by the same token, it's also allowing people who allow their appetite to kind of being built up from people they see on the internet and facilitating their return to TV screens because, you know, for such a long time, they felt so underserved. And so it's kind of like, yeah, making sure we kind of, essentially BAMIS is trying to build that virtual bridge between broadcast and digital media.
So what's the future big picture for BAMIS then?
Best case scenario for me would be that, like, you know, we run a few seasons whereby it becomes such a British comedy institution that I don't necessarily have to be on the show or have to exist in that kind of capacity, and I can happily be like an exec producer behind the camera. Because, you know, with all art, really, it's got to be bigger than yourself. And you know, this is not about me being the final word on or being, you know, the apex of creativity within comedy. In some ways, you're going to have to get over your ego and realize that you're a brick in the wall. So I guess I'm just trying to, yeah, build an institution that people can continue to push. So in the same way that like middle class people have like Monty Python or Fast Train, you know, or we've even had the Real McCoy, and that was over 2 decades ago, three. So I'd really, I guess, ideally, I'd want to famous to do for today's diaspora what the Real McCoy did 25 plus years ago. I want it to be, I want famous to be to black culture and British culture what Soccer AM is to football.
Love it. Love it. And here's hoping that that happens, Dane. Where can we go and find out more about BAMUS or watch it? That's the most important. That's the best way we can support it, right? Watch it and talk about it online.
Please do. Yeah. Please do support it. But at the same time, check it out and enjoy it, man. It's a very funny show. I stand by it. It's still currently available on the BBC iPlayer along with my sitcom Sunny D. So please do check that out as well. But yeah, if you put BAMUS in on all your good socials, then it will come up. But yeah, you can find it on BBC iPlayer. And we just finished having a run last week on BBC One, where we were doing mock the week numbers. So if that helps people to get across it, that's what we've been doing, y'all.
Say that again for the people at back. What kind of numbers is that?
Mock the week and numbers. You know that week? We mocked that for the whole week in one day. So, and Naomi Campbell says so, everybody. So even Naomi Campbell got a nice little co-sign. So yeah, it's been very well received. And, you know, and so far as the elementary objectives of BAMUS, they've all been satisfied, and I've been very happy. Like I said, for someone like Naomi Campbell, who herself has been a massive, massive trailblazer and existed in a space where she wouldn't have seen a lot of people that look like herself, it's very important that an institution like that exists to recognise that kind of work. Because, you know, someone like Naomi Campbell, she, you know, she walked or catwalked so that, you know, your Chloe's and Haley's and, you know, all the, your Rihanna's and everyone now that's been able to make this, women of colour making a transition into the fashion world, like she walks, catwalks, everybody else could run. So, you know, way before people were comfortable with black aesthetics in the form of like, you know, RuPaul's Drag Race and America's Next Top Model with Tyra Banks, like Naomi Campbell was there way back. Like when we talk about like even Breaking America and stuff, like Naomi Campbell was in the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
That's
the level of significance she has. So to have somebody like that who's been such a trailblazer celebrate BAMUS as well, it's definitely the objective. So yeah, man, it's been all good. And I want people to enjoy it. Like I really, in a way that comedy is like an honest form of politics, like I'm definitely the BAMUS, I want people to think of BAMUS as not just a, you know, a show, but it's an institution. And I work as a civil servant. Like the idea is that I just want to create, I just want to plant the tree in it. If people want to decide what the fruit is I just want to make the restaurant and you can decide what the meals are. Like, I just feel like there are people who are from all of these subsectors of the diaspora, whether they may be northern-based, southern-based, maybe they're football or sports fans or basketball fans, genre of music fans, maybe you're into the church. It could be even, you know, scholars, academics that have been able to inspire people. Like the two youngest entrants to Cambridge on their maths exam are Nigerian people, Nigerian kids. We just had a recent entry into Mensa from a kid who has a higher IQ than Einstein. And all I want is to create a vehicle which allows people to know all of this stuff if they choose. Knowledge is definitely power. So I'm just, BAMUS is kind of like a generator.
Nice. And I wish you all the best of it. And I'll support you how best I can, man. I'm with you all the way, Dane, man. And it's, Dane's a very serious guy when you have conversations with him like this. But don't think the show isn't just rip raw joke after joke as well.
All day. We're celebrating. I don't want to give any away. But essentially, we're celebrating. And I think once we are able to celebrate it and have this conversation, I think that it will definitely ease race relations. And having a point of reference for everybody to kind of, like, I just think once you know where you come from, it's always easy to know where you're going. And I think that existential question of where the fuck are we going is at the forefront of everybody's lips in the current times we live in.
Yeah.
So I think my contribution to that is to be like, if we know where we've come from, that will help us to work out where we're going to go next. So
Yeah. I feel like it helps you to be more less apologetically yourself. So like, I feel like part of moving forward, I mean, this is my personal journey, is I feel like I've made the most progress when I'm just like, you know what, this is me. This is what I'm about. This is what I like. And I look at all of the best opportunities I've had, and they've always been the fruit of that mindset. You know, I'm not saying to disregard trying to do things of the best quality that you can, or trying to get the best out of something, or thinking about, you know, the audience that you're creating stuff for. But being proud of it just being your own thing and making it yours and being yourself, like, bruv, I feel like that's helped to help my trajectory totally. And I feel like Bamus is so Dane. It's very Dane. Like, I feel like it's just you. Do you know what I mean?
Amazing. That's exactly, that's what I want for it. I really want it to be a reflection of myself. And I wholeheartedly agree with everything you said, Marcus. I think it's been the same for me, is that being the truest version of self has always led to the most lucrative and the most prosperous opportunities. And I think, and again, I just think it's a real point essentially where people can kind of be moving towards. It's like, you know, you only have to live with yourself. And I think more in lockdown, if you have with yourself, lockdown is hard for you. It can be very hard for you. So yeah, again, it's definitely encouraging that kind of well-being and stuff. So I completely agree with you, bro. Agree with you.
Cool, man. All right. Should we have a little talk about what's going on in the world of tech though, before we wrap up the show?
Of course. It wouldn't be the pod if we didn't kill the hour properly.
You get me? Talk about a little bit of tech. Do you know what I mean? To be fair, Dane, when I told people that I wanted to do a tech podcast, it kind of, everybody was like, huh? But you come from One Extra though. Like, isn't it going to be a hip hop podcast? I was like, no, I like hip hop, but I also like tech and sci-fi and stuff. It was a really weird, it was.
I had people play the music in the studio. Do you understand how tech works? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
But it's such an important point, because like, when you think about how much it's contributed to helping some level of equality of representation online, like, you've had to have a good grasp of tech for that to happen.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. 100%, man, 100%. Yeah, fascinating. Anyway, in the world of tech, Dane, so Steph Curry, on his official YouTube channel, he's doing an exclusive set of interviews called State of Inspiration. Really nice. And you know what? Steph Curry, he's just a wholesome guy, isn't he, really? And he's flipping good at basketball really as well.
you can't get any better. The guy, tall, dark, handsome, talented, seems wholesome, takes care of his family and stuff.
Exactly.
I wouldn't be mad if I woke up one day and I did a body swap with Steph Curry, tell you that much.
Yeah, he's doing all right. He's doing all right. Yeah.
A little Freaky Friday at Steph Curry wouldn't be too bad.
Oh man, that'd be a great day. But on his podcast, on his interviews though, recently though, Dane, he had Bill Gates, one of the richest men in the world, philanthropist, depending on how you feel about
those. depending on what part of the internet you exist on,
the devil himself
or Satan.
Satan of vaccines.
So they actually have a chat.
Come on,
about
guys, he's a nerd, man. I'm not having it, Bev. Bill Gates is going to kill the whole world. Slap him in it, if that's how you feel. It's like Bill Gates.
I'm not saying I'm a great judge of character, but when I look at Bill Gates, he doesn't ooze evil to me. He doesn't look like, how shall I take over the world? He doesn't come across like that. If I'm wrong, does, hey, quote me on that. Does,
exactly, but even if he does, like, he also looks like a fall on ice would kill him. So for me, that's not that menacing a figure. Like, Bill Gates might be evil, but he also looks like he's allergic to nuts. And I can't take someone like that as a megalomaniac that seriously. If I can kill you with a Snickers bar, how evil can you be? Like, you can look at Bill Gates and he's like, he's evil. Evil? Vaccines? Gluten is going to kill this man. Come on, guys. A bread roll would have him up in the hospital on life support. So how dangerous is Bill Gates really, people? Come on, man.
Him and Curry, they do talk about COVID. They talk about food insecurity as well. That's a big issue that we've been discussing. Education, remote learning, unemployment. But whilst they also tackled a few of those things, they also had a conversation about job interviews. And they kind of, what Steph said was, Bill, I want you to pretend you're interviewing for a software engineering job at Microsoft.
Let's say you're interviewing for a junior engineer position at Microsoft. Sitting in a boardroom or on video call in 2020, why should we hire you?
You should look at the code that I've written. You know, I'm kind of crazy. I write software programs way beyond any classes that I've taken and think I've gotten better over time. So take a look at how ambitious I've been there. I do think I can work well with people. I might criticize their code a little harshly, but overall, I like to be on a team. I like ambitious goals. I like thinking through how we can anticipate the future. Software is cool, and I want to be involved.
Why does his job interview answer sound as generic as all of us does when we get asked that question, Dave?
Because it is that generic answer. It's a generic answer, and you know what? It's very revelatory, because it's like, people should understand how little your professed competence in your job plays in the job interviews.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Bill Gates, like I said, to listen to that, Bill Gates sounds like any software programmer ever, anywhere, ever in the world.
but we're aware that he's Bill Gates. And to be honest, it's quite, I find it, it's interesting to hear him respond to it, but when you would consider like someone like Bill Gates' disposition, I couldn't even see Bill Gates letting some other nerd ask him, why do you think you'd be good for this position? He'd be like, thank you for your time. I will leave and do my own coding.
Yeah, and he'll turn around at the end of his interview and say, you've got the job or not, to his interviewers. That's what he'll say.
Yeah,
why,
exactly.
Why do all of these hyper nerds, hyper rich nerds, the majority of them are sounding like Kermit the Frog ripoffs nowadays? Why is Bill Gates sounding more like, Mark sounds totally like Kermit the Frog. Yeah, Bill Gates sounds like Kermit the Frog's uncle. I've got a couple of more questions I'll give you answers to. The one after this is really exciting, but the second interview question was, how do you define your strengths and weaknesses and how would you incorporate them into a team?
Well, I'm not somebody who knows a lot about marketing. You know, I wouldn't enjoy being a salesman. For a position where you're actually creating the products and thinking through what those features should be, I'm fascinated by that. I followed the history of the industry, read about the mistakes that have been made. So product definition, product creation, very strong. If you have a team that understands the customers, the sales, the marketing, I'm not going to bring that, but I would enjoy working with them.
So if Bareface says what he didn't like doing.
Yeah, but I think he's saying that, and I have a theory on this. And it's a part of the whole kind of complex of applying for a job and other stuff anyway, is that obviously Bill Gates is not saying what he thinks. He's saying what he thinks an employer wants to hear. So by him saying, I don't know that good at marketing, what he's saying is that I recognize that other departments exist and you delegate tasks to them. And I'm happy to work as a cog within this machine and interact with your other cogs, is what he really means. So I think, I guess, job interviews are very similar to IQ tests, is that you get good at them just from practice and,
yeah,
and telling people what they want to hear. Because, like, I don't know, I feel like people know whether or not they like you before you open your mouth at a job interview anyway. So, you know, if you, for example, if you are a woman that looks a certain way and people are aware that will attract a certain amount of attention, that might go great for you if you are being interviewed by two very pervy men. If you're being interviewed by two women who have been beaten down and embittered by corporate misogyny, they might not want you to work there at all. So I think most people make a decision in the same way they do with, like, in sales. They say they buy the person and not the product. And I think the same applies with, like, sales and stuff as well. It doesn't really matter what you're saying. It's just more about the main overarching question is, are you going to work for us? It's not whether or not you can work. It's whether you can work for your employer. That's the difference. Where they go, that's what are some of your strengths and weaknesses. My weakness is the fact that I don't have enough money to support myself without getting a job.
That's the answer I always wanted to give.
That's the answer to, because that's the answer to everyone's question.
Why, because I have to.
Exactly. Why do you really want this job? Money. You know it. I know it. How dare you?
Yeah. Really? But my name's Bill, but every month I'm greeted by a number of bills. They come through my letterbox. Or now they just come straight out of my account via direct debit. And I need certain things. Like, I need Uber Eats every other day. Yes, that is an actual requirement of mine. Yes.
I sound like somebody who could attract women with charisma, sir. So I need the last time a woman was positive with me, it was with C++. And so I asked a lady if she'd come back to my place for coffee, and she said, don't I prefer JavaScript? And so because of this, I need, yeah. It's like I was saying to a friend the other day, like, dating websites don't give a fuck about you.
Mm-mm.
Because their business model depends on people being single and looking for love. So yeah, if everybody was happy by the matches that were made, they wouldn't need to return back to a dating site to continue the process, which means that business model would only be particularly finite, which means they are incentivized to almost suggest temporary or incorrect matches, because that means if people's matches or their dating fucks up, they go back to the dating site. If dating sites are supposed to work whereby you're supposed to find love, you wouldn't need to use them again. And so their business model is kind of based on people being unhappy, in the same way that if you're a recruitment consultant, as a recruitment consultant, you're not trying to find people jobs where they will be long-term fulfilled in their careers, because that means that you don't get any more commission. So that's why every 3 months they go, how's it going? Because they are hoping that you still have that same professional dissatisfaction so they can continue to monetize your ennui about your particular job, which is why I tell people, the word consultant, if you rearrange the letters, it actually spells nah, lost cunt. Because all the consultant is doing, you paid them to tell you the time on your own watch.
Yeah.
I said it.
I love consultancy jobs. If you want to have me as a consultant, I will be there for you. I think consultancy...
Exactly. It's a great job when, like, look at consultancy when someone goes, yeah, like,
do you think I should like? It's like if you was a cake or something, do you think I should check out the oven now?
Not yet.
£1,000, please.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if you take it out of the oven and it's too early, you can be like, well, yeah, you didn't tell me what time you put it in the oven specifically. Next time is what you should do. And if it comes out perfect, you'd be like, right, that's my consultancy, and that's proof that I work. So yeah, consultancy is very interesting.
And someone goes, what the fuck are you talking about, Marcus? The cake's burnt. Let's look at the strengths and weaknesses. The strengths are that the oven works well. The weaknesses being maybe your keenness of vision. Mm. Opportunities, the opportunity to make another cake with less burnt.
Yes. Crust on the side. We've all learned today.
So we've all learned today. Yeah. £1,000, please.
There you go. Right. So the question that I think kind of has garnered the most attention is salary expectations. Because obviously Bill Gates, one of the richest men in the world. So how would he answer that question? How would one of the richest people in the world answer with their own mentality?
What would be your salary expectations for this job and something that you'd be comfortable with?
I hope the option package is good. You know, I'm able to take risk. And I think the company has a great future. So I'd prefer to get stock options even more than cash compensation. I hear some other companies are paying a lot, but treat me fairly and emphasize the options.
I like the little leverage play there. That was nice.
Did you hear the little chuckle when he got asked about money? He went, as in like money completed that.
Yeah, he's like, I remember the word, but money you say?
It's in an area of my mind with hunger and other things as well. Need.
Need. Yeah, he had no idea. Money? He said, this money thing sounds lovely. Keep that on the back burner. Now, stock.
Yeah, that was big. Do you know what, though? Stock. To be fair, there's something to learn from that, though. Like, if you do believe in your own product or the product that you're working with, to ask for options or some kind of reward for success shows that you are confident within a product, that you're willing to offer that as a company, and also that you're willing to invest your extra effort at the ground up to be, shall we say, compensated further along down the line. Mm-hmm. When things are good. So I found that quite interesting, though, from him, because a lot of people will only think about the now when it comes to money instead of thinking about the future.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. I think, yeah, like I said, it's about big picture thinking. And I think that, however, I will say, does come from a place of privilege that obviously he's a very learned man when it comes to like finance and stuff. And
yeah, man.
Most people, because their presence at a job interview is a lot more dependent upon their remuneration than Bill Gates. So he's not thinking of money not being the object. There's not a bill coming the next week, or he hasn't got a mortgage to pay. So for him, he can sit down and come and say that. But at the same time, like you said, I agree, I don't think it's necessarily a financial thing. It's a mentality thing. Mm. And he's Bill Gates probably shares the same characteristics as a lot of people, whereby he understands that he, like you said, you realize your most prosperity when you get to be yourself.
Mm.
I think Bill Gates probably has the same kind of sentiment as well, whereby he's aware of his value and what applies to a company. And so, yeah, it makes sense, man, that he would kind of, and also there's almost like a kind of etiquette to it, that it's a good way of demonstrating to an employer or demonstrating to a collaborator that you're not just in it for the money anyway. And that's actually quite an effective interview method, or when you're working with somebody, because like me, for example, like with Bamus, I made it very clear to the other co-producers, like, listen, if I've got to sleep in a studio for us to make this as good as possible, that's on mine now. Like, Or also explain to them the fact that, like, I know a lot of the time people will want to have a producer credit for the back end, but I am executively involved in this from a consultative perspective, whereby I will be there in every step of the way in the edit itself as well, because it means that much to me. So, it does betray a common character trait amongst like entrepreneurs, I think.
Yeah.
About the bigger picture more than anything, because did you hear a story about the dude got a sneaker deal in the NBA, and I think he was either offered stock options or he was offered I think it was 250,000,
yeah,
which he took the latter, and the stock options were in a relatively unknown company at the time called Nike, bruv. And I think they said today his stock would be worth about 100 million now.
There you go. I actually read 50 Cent's book. It's called Hustle Harder, I think it is, or Hustle Smarter, sorry, or Curtis Jackson's book. I read that the other day, and he speaks about one of the mixtape producers that he worked with. I won't drop his name when I let you read the book, but he worked with a mixtape producer who he went down to his basement studio and recorded some content with. Now, when 50 got signed, he said an invoice came in from said producer without him having the conversation with him. And he was like, "All right, well, one, that's a bit like weird. Talk to me, innit? I'm still here. Let's have the conversation and let us know that you want some money. Two, how about I offer you slightly less money and I give you a point on my album?" And a point is in the record industry is just like, just call it a percentage. Do you know what I mean? Like, take 5% of my album sales. And the producer was so adamant that he got paid directly and didn't get the point on the album, which then went on to sell like 10 million copies.
You know, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Would have been worth a lot more than the money that he asked for. Yeah.
This is it. Because you're thinking, like, even with Jason Weaver, who played the voice of Simba on Lion King, he was offered initially, I think he was offered a $500,000 buyout. And his mother said he wouldn't take it, and he took a point instead on the song. Just Can't Wait to Be King. So still eating today.
So, yeah, eating like a lion.
Has the lion's share even today.
Yeah.
Even Beyonce, when Beyonce did Homecoming on Netflix,
instead
of taking the buyout fee, she took shares in Netflix.
There you go. Ooh, shares in Netflix. Oh, that's nice. I mean, at the same time, I'm not trying to say I'm a business guru. It can go wrong. You can take the point, or you can take the shares instead of the fee. Everything gets fucked up.
It can happen. It can happen either way. But at the same time, it's always going to be more palatable, a lesson rather than a loss, if you are in control of it. If you make the choice, I can take that on board. That's how responsibility works. And again, it's a part of the whole complex of being an entrepreneur or being a creator. Or
100%.
You take those risks, but it's high risk and high reward, and you get the choice and all of that. And, you know, in many ways, though the opportunity to fail can be there, it's still a lot more exciting than just knowing, waking up every day and knowing what's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, for me, and I'm not knocking anyone that's got a 9-to-5. I'm not knocking anyone that's got a regular job or a very fixed routine. I've worked like that, and I'm very good at work. And I would, if you ever need to, work that 9-to-5 job, and it's cool. But I feel like for me, I enjoy project based work. I enjoy the excitement and variety that you get out of that. And there's positives and negatives around both of those. But like, I think if I was to just take gigs all the time and everything was just a fixed gig and it had nothing to do with my performance, I just got paid and all right, you did all right. So you get paid the same amount. It didn't do that well, you get paid the same amount. I'd fall out of love with the game. Everything that I'm involved in where I have a direct relation to the success of it and I can get like rewarded from that if I do well, I feel like I'll put the extra effort in. And I feel like a team of people that know that they're working towards a shared goal, like that have, you know, if we do well off this, we're not just going to have fun. We're going to eat off this as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Compared to if we do well off this, we'll get paid the same amount as if we don't. You kind of get that kind of employee mentality where you're like, you know what? Because the one of the things I loved about working, like, you know, in retail and stuff like that, was I could come in and have a bit of a half-assed day, still get paid the same. I could come in feeling great, still get paid the same. And I thought that was great. That's a great, have sick pay. That was amazing for me. Have a day or annual leave. Fuck, I'm so jealous of people with annual leave. You get me? But, you know, it's how it is.
I think because you're younger and you're entering into industry, so in any kind of new arena you find yourself in, there always needs to be some element of stability and routine for you to kind of understand and boundaries.
Yeah, exactly, well. Exactly.
But as time goes on, like you said, I feel like, you know, you get to a point where especially because work is such a large part of the human existence, then you want it to be a part of you that's quite fulfilling. I think, like I said, if people want to have the structured and do the routine thing,
nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with it. But I do think, however, for the sake of human well-being, there has to be an outlet outside of your either professional or social obligations where your whole drive is just yourself and you're fulfilled by your actions and it is an expression of yourself. And that can even be like the way in which you could be the way you make a sandwich, to be honest with you. But you need some, I think it's important, especially the times we're in now where there's a point of expression where you are at your most unabashed, unashamed, unapologetic self. And like I said, even if it's a smaller something, as the way you make a cup of tea. Every human being needs some form of expression, some way of imprinting their existence onto something just so they can perceive it. And like I said, it's just like holding up a mirror to yourself. So yeah, I'm definitely like you, man. I think the idea of trusting my fate in the hands of somebody else isn't something that ever kind of sat well with me. And I didn't, and also, like I said, I don't think it lent to me realizing my full creative potential anyway. So I used to work in like Iceland at the supermarket, and like I said, I liked it. Whether I'm good, bad, hungover and stuff, I just go and chill at work and do my job in it. But a job and work are two different things, I think. And so there are a number of different parts of our lives where we have moral obligations, whether it's paying tax, abiding by laws, whether it's helping your family out in particular ways, or But, you know, there has to be something that the only thing that drives you is your own drive, I think, for the sake of your well-being.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man. 100%, Dane. Before we get out of here, though, we are talking about more things that are less kind of topical so that they last a little bit longer, basically. But there is something that's been doing the rounds on the internet, a little bit silly way of us to way of us finishing off the show. I don't know if you heard about the girl that tried to do her hair and ran out of this product called Hairy Glue or whatever. She's she decided to use Gorilla Glue instead to fix her slick back ponytail. Now, I'll start with the positives. You are probably aware of this if you're listening to the show, but, you know, let's just give you it. The ponytail was very well, very slick, very neat and tidy.
Amazing. It looked amazing.
It looked fantastic.
Amazing. Yeah, she looked great.
However, her hair was stuck like that, and she's kind of been campaigning to get her hair fixed. I don't know where she's at the moment. Last time I got an update, she'd gone to a couple of specialists and they'd given her some nail varnish remover sachets to use in her hair. But what was your take on this, Dane?
My take on it is that we wish for a very speedy recovery. But the lady in question, the update I found out is recently her Instagram account has become verified. So she's now become an online personality.
I saw she had 500,000 followers, but she's now verified. Okay, cool.
Yeah, now she's verified as a result of it. And unfortunately, I think they've had to remove the part of her scalp, the hair on the scalp.
Okay. Fuck.
Yeah, they have removed all the part of the Gorilla Glue, so all the baby hairs and the edges that she's so impeccably stuck down have to be removed. So hopefully it'll grow again naturally, or she can get a transplant. But I think the best thing and the most sensible thing would be for the investment in the state of the black woman's hair and scalp to be rivaled with that of NASA. And I won't rest until the research into the protection, curation, and enhancement of the hair of black women is invested in as much as the Israeli Defense Force.
100%, bro. Because
it's the only way.
We cannot have this happen again.
This can't happen again. Never again. Not on our watch. Protect black women. Protect their scalps, Marcus. Because if you don't, you're going to hear about Marcus. Is that what you want? Is that what you want? Because I don't want
I don't want this. I don't want black women's hair to be known. I don't want that. I don't want this to be the biggest thing in black women's hair in 2021. All right. Because so far it is. We need to change things. Do you know what though? Like I actually thought it was a joke, and it wasn't until I saw her putting moisture on it and like putting shampoo in it, I was like, oh my God, she actually has put super glue on her hair. And I was like, she can't be the only person in the world that's done that. It can't be the first person that's done that out there. So do we have to give a public disclaimer to say, do not put Gorilla Glue on your hair if you're listening to this show? Do not put any type of glue in your hair, please.
I mean, yeah, if we're going to be responsible and educate and entertain, do not put any type of glue in your hair. And unless it's bonding glue. And even then, it's only supposed to bond to the tracks, ladies.
You do need that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? I don't even want to say, that's what I'm saying, Mark. This is such a politically tense issue that I don't want to even risk being seen to be mansplaining the nuance and the equivalent competence for astrophysics that is the hair of black women. I'm just going to say, let's hope she pulls through. And like I said, more research into the protection and curation of the scalps of black women. Because, yeah, I mean, you would think you shouldn't put Gorilla Glue on your hair. But then my sister also used to have this type of hair gel that was called jam. And that shouldn't be on toast.
Yeah, I had some jam as well. That helped my hair curl up. I've got long hair at the top as well. I used to throw that jam in.
That's what I'm saying. This is what I'm saying. Like, you know, that's it. We want to keep...
Did it smell nice? Yes. Did I maybe lick a little bit of it when no one was looking? That remains to be proven. Maybe.
We're not going
to
sit here, Marcus Brunsie, and act like people have not seen cherry flavor lip seal and tried that shit. I'm not going to sit here, audience. We're not going to sit here and have you infer that you've not been to Body Shop and seen a delicious type of shea butter spread and thought...
Exactly.
I'll buy it.
Exactly.
We've all been there, guys. We've all been there. I always tell you, if you're gonna put fruits in people's hair products and delicious things, they're gonna try it. Mm. And Gorilla Glue just sounds strong. Gorillas are strong, vegans, but they're also endangered.
Yes,
and that's why you shouldn't glue their glue to your head.
And I like that line of logic there, Dane. I think that's how we wrap up today's show. Where can we find you online, Mr. Baptiste?
I'm on all your good socials, so find me on your Insta, Twitter, Facebook, etc. And just look up Dane Baptiste, you should be able to find me. Mm-hmm. But I would please encourage everybody to check out Bamus on BBC iPlayer. It is a very, very funny show, if I do say so myself. Mm-hmm. I also, Naomi Campbell says so as well. You want to say Naomi Campbell's wrong? Do you like getting slapped in your face? Why do you hate Skepta? Grow up, everyone. We have loads of fun. But yeah, I'm on all your good socials, and people can also find me on my podcast, Question Everything, which is available on Acast as well. So yeah, I'm about.
Nice, man. Thank you very much. You can follow me at Marcus Bronzy, MarcusBronzy on all socials. And obviously this show is at How to Kill an Hour everywhere as well. Dane, we'll make sure that we put a link to Bamus in the show description and also to all your social medias as well. Thank you very much for killing some time with us.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for having me, sir.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.